This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The White House says the two attacks in Kenya on Thanksgiving Day may have been perpetrated by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center on 9/11. In Mombasa, a car loaded with explosives was driven into an Israeli-owned hotel, killing 10 Kenyans, 3 Israelis, and the 3 bombers. Almost simultaneously, a commercial airliner was nearly struck with a shoulder-fired rocket from the ground. Wayne Madsen is an investigative reporter with a journal called Intelligence Online.
I see nothing connecting the war on Iraq with the obviously what looks to be an Al-Qaeda attack on the Israeli passenger plane and the hotel. Israeli-owned hotel. A lot of people are trying to make that connection. I think a lot of people in the Bush administration would love to make that connection. But I mean, today the UN, I guess it was yesterday, the UN inspectors toured a distillery north of Baghdad. Now, that doesn't sound like the type of country that Bin Laden would be very happy with, a country that allows a distillery to produce alcoholic beverages. So the right wing hawks in this administration trying to link Saddam to Al Qaeda, I think, are way off base. They just don't know the history of the Middle East, past or recent past.
Mm-hmm. And so this event over the weekend has nothing to do with the Bush administration's war agenda, or and in no way should be further proof or evidence that the U.S. has to go to war against Iran.
Oh, absolutely not. And anybody who would suggest that, you know, the attack in Mombasa is anyway linked to, you know, what Saddam Hussein is doing or not doing vis-a-vis the, you know, the UN weapons inspectors. By the way, they haven't found anything yet. I think that's kind of interesting as well. So I think any attempt to try to link the two is just a continuation of the war hawks, what some people call the chicken hawks in this administration, the Cheneys, the Rumsfelds, the Wolfowitzes, and others, trying to make this link. But I think what happened in Kenya has to be looked at from the perspective of what Bin Laden reportedly said in his last communique, that he added Israel, Britain, France, Germany, Canada, and other countries on the list of countries that were subject to attack. And it looks like this attack on the Israelis was just basically carrying out one part of that threat.
Well, now, that attack actually involved surface-to-air missiles, or SAMs, I believe, as they're called.
Right, Russian, Soviet-made SAM-7s in this case.
They're considered to be the weapons of choice for terrorists?
Well, there's a whole lot of these types of weapons out there and available. Africa certainly has seen its fair share of the use of such weapons. In the United States, actually, provided some of these surface-to-air missiles to various countries in Africa after we captured them from the Iraqis after the first war against Iraq. They were given primarily to Uganda, which in turn gave them to their allies in Rwanda and the Southern People's Liberation Army fighting the government of Sudan. So I guess the thing that makes this attack in Kenya look a little suspicious as far as Bin Laden's involvement is the serial number. Number on this these particular SAM launchers were very close to the serial numbers on the similar SAM-7 found outside the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia.
Why does that make it more suspicious?
Well, it appears that they came from the same, possibly the same weapons sale or the same weapons delivery or the same weapons cache. Obviously, in the case of the Saudi missile launcher that was found, Al-Qaeda, you know, had their fingerprints all over that particular incident. And the fact that this particular missile launcher is very close as far as the serial numbers indicate that they come from the same source.
From the Saudis as opposed to certainly
from, you know, the Al-Qaeda people. We know from, you know, recently that, you know, there's a lot of Saudis who are bankrolling the purchase of these weapons. So obviously the trail goes back more to the Saudis than it does to the Iraqis.
But how are these likely to factor into any kind of upcoming war scenario in Iraq if these surface-to-air missiles, these SAMs, are sort of proliferated out there? And I understand there are also reports that hundreds of these Stinger missiles were provided to Afghanistan, Afghanistan's anti-Soviet Mujahideen forces back in the 1980s.
They were, and in one case, the government of Qatar, where we have one of our major bases, bought some of those Stingers from those Mujahideen sources in Afghanistan. The United States was quite upset with the government, and now, of course, that government is one of our, you know, supposed allies in the region. These Stingers proliferated. I mean, this was because the Reagan-Bush administration thought that the Soviet Union was a greater threat than providing this type of weaponry to, you know, the Mujahideen, when in fact we knew that, you know, they weren't going to stop with, you know, going after the Soviets. We know that, you know, eventually they turned some of this training, some of this weaponry on the United States. So, you know, a very bad decision by the people in the Reagan and Bush administration, and unfortunately many of these people are back into the foreign policy decision-making apparatus of this current Bush 2 administration.
And so their weapons are now possibly going to be trained at the U.S. in any sort of war theater in Iraq.
Right, and we only have to look to, you know, people like John Poindexter, who's now back working at the Pentagon, Elliot Abrams, who's now at the National Security Council, and some of these other players, including Colin Powell, who was certainly part of that whole decision-making process, are now, you know, bemoaning the fact that Al-Qaeda has possession of these various weapons like the Stingers, when in fact it was their decisions back during Reagan-Bush that enabled these weapons to fall in the hands of these people.
And what's the connection? Connect the dots for us between Al-Qaeda and the Mujahideen, and how these are the same weapons.
Well,
possibly.
Right. I mean, basically the Mujahideen was pretty much a hodgepodge of various groups opposed to the Soviet invasion. You know, there were some people say with some moderates in the Mujahideen. I mean, that's all relative. But basically, the United States provided a lot of training, a lot of money, a lot of weapons through Pakistan's intelligence agency, which we know later helped create the Taliban. And the Taliban, of course, provided sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. A lot of the money that the U.S. originally provided was from Saudi sources. So obviously, the fact that bin Laden acceded to the call to go help their Muslim brethren in Afghanistan and started to recruit people in that war effort from various Arab countries and other Muslim countries, this was the kernel, the seed that eventually created Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden started Al-Qaeda in 1988, but before that time, he had been working with the CIA in Afghanistan. He had been working with Pakistani intelligence. He got a lot of money from wealthy Saudis, including members of the Saudi royal family, same sources that he gets money from apparently to this day, including possibly the wife of Bush's good friend, Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador here in Washington.
Investigative reporter Wayne Mattson writes for the online journal Intelligence. President Bush has decided to allow the extension for unemployment payments to expire, placing hundreds of thousands of Americans at risk. Provisions in the American Homeland Security Act destroys protection for federal civil service jobs, and the administration attack on unions continues. Maya Schoen and Ralph Schoeman, commentators on Pacifica Station WBAI, say Iraqis won't be the only casualties of this impending war.
This is Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen.
Newsday on November 28th ran an article called "The Economy, a Casualty of the War," and it describes how that every day of warfare with the pending war in Iraq will have an enormous cost for working people, which will entail a wholesale reduction of social services, of health protections, of every form of social service by the state as a consequence. And in many ways, Maya, we could talk about the war preparations as a weapon of mass distraction, because the contrivance of a war against Iraq is also a cover for an all-out assault on working people in the United States.
Well, the $200 billion $1 billion that they will spend to wage a war against the peoples of Iraq and the Middle East go to enrich the pockets, line the pockets of major corporations like Lockheed and Brown and Root. But a war is taking place against the workers of the United States. Aside from the private sector and the attempts to dismantle the unions, there is an attempt at the federal level against the 1.8 million federal civilian jobs. When President Bush announced that by executive decree, he could call for contracting out of the work that the of at least 850,000 workers, and he wants to start with 15% of the jobs to be open to competition by next October. That means the federal workers, particularly those who are computer programmers, map makers, engineers, landscapers, road builders, even eyeglass makers, are going to have to bid against themselves, against non-union, lower-paid workers without benefits and without protections against being hired and fired at will. They're going to have to compete against themselves to come in lower than the private sector.
So really the war is a class war against the people of Iraq and the theft of their oil, against the people of the United States and their living standards. The Christmas gift to the jobless will be 1 million loss of benefits by December 28th, and a further 100,000 will lose their benefits in the following week. A total of 2.1 million people will lose all benefits, that is to say their ability to survive, as a consequence of this war on working people. And indeed, Maya, the Washington Post ran a piece in which the now new target, as described in the Wall Street Journal, of the government will be low-income taxpayers, which are called new meat for the right. While the corporations pay no taxes for 10 years at a time, the working poor, people with $12,000 or less, are going to be targeted for great tax increases, even though their FICA, or the money taken out of their paychecks, are at a higher rate by far than the percentages paid by the ruling rich in the United States.
And a good proportion of their income goes for the regressive tax of sales tax. So here we have a war against the people of the United States, the working class of the United States, as well as the workers abroad. It's time for a major fight back to build up our anti-war movement and to fight for our representation by unions in the workplace.
And in that regard, there's going to be a very important national conference on December 7th in San Francisco, the National Labor Conference Against Taft-Hartley and Union Busting, which is going to be participated in by the longshore workers both in San Francisco and from Charleston, South Carolina, by the Maritime Trades Council, by Teamsters, transportation workers, by workers across the country. I'll be giving a major talk there and a panel on the relationship of the war and the war on working people. It's part of the fight back, the resistance to the police state that the Homeland Security Act represents and the all-out assault on the ability of working people to maintain their union organization and their ability to defend their rights in this country.
This is Maya Schoen.
And Ralph Schoenman.
They are commentators at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Well, as the buildup for war against Iraq is amplified by the mainstream media, a growing list of domestic issues are overlooked and underfunded, according to some. Many in Washington are trying to shed light on a tie between the cut in funding for treatment of AIDS and money spent on weapons and troops abroad. In preparation for the World AIDS Day, over 500 concerned citizens marched in Washington, D.C. last Tuesday, demanding funding for AIDS treatment instead of funding for the war. At the 19th Annual Robert Kennedy Awards Ceremony, Dr. Jim Kim, director of the Program for Infectious Diseases and Social Change, celebrated making health advocacy a human rights issue. Reem Kathuta of WPFW in Washington asked Kim whether Bush's administration's buildup for war against Iraq is overshadowing the need for funds for AIDS domestically and in developing countries.
We are told that we have to prove that money in developing countries for health care can be used effectively. And the burden of proof is very high. We're asking for $2.5 billion a year to go to the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. At the same time, when we look at the increase in the defense budget, or if we look at the $1.35 trillion tax cut, we should be asking more questions. Will $1.35 trillion in tax cuts, 60% of which would go to the rich, will those tax cuts actually lead to better economic performance? Well, I've just seen no evidence, but it's taken as gospel. So I think we have a lot to do in terms of asking much more critical questions.
People are taking to the streets to oppose the war against Iraq and say that they'd rather have their programs funded.
When we went to the Treasury Department and to the U.S. government and asked them for $2.5 billion to combat the worst epidemic in history, an epidemic that will without question have an impact on our economic life and on the stability of an entire continent, we were told that there's no money. No money for treatment after, but also prevention, care, and all the other aspects of a healthcare system that can deliver those kinds of services. We were told that there's no money, and there was only about $100 million. But when President Bush said that we were going to go to war in Iraq for unclear purposes, in my mind, the Treasury Department said, no problem, we can make $100 billion available overnight. We're talking about $350 billion a year, plus an additional $100 billion to wage war. This is an enormous amount of money. We have to look really carefully at what the expenditures are going to. We're increasing the defense budget by $37 billion this year. It's never been clear to me how that increased expenditure is going to help us to fight terrorism. I've never understood that. But this is a question we should be asking of those who are asking for an increased defense budget. We feel that it's not really a question of money. From the way money is distributed with absolutely no justification, that there's plenty of money around to do all the right things that we should do, provide everyone in the U.S. with health care, really take on the problems of malnutrition and lack of housing and violence and infectious diseases in developing countries. Something that you hear these days is, well, you're not going to solve the problems in developing countries by throwing money at the problem. I have to say that the problems in the developing world are problems like hunger and lack of access to health care. The way we solve those problems is precisely by throwing money at them. When we're hungry, we buy food. When we need health care, we buy health insurance and get health care. When we need medicines, we buy medicines. When people say you can't solve these problems by throwing money at them, there's a point. We shouldn't give money to the wrong people. We shouldn't give money to despotic leaders. We shouldn't give money and not ask for any accountability. It is money that we need. We need to get much, much better at making programs work in the U.S. and making programs work in developing countries. But you can't do that if there's no money to even begin.
Dr. Kim, what are your comments about the effect of sanctions on Haiti and the respect or disrespect of sovereignty, particularly that these are two issues that we struggle with as we look at Iraq and talks of the Bush administration of a need for a regime change?
The role of the United States goes very, very deep. First of all, there was an embargo in 1804. Haiti was not recognized by the United States until 1862 because of fear that an independent country in which black people were in the majority ran the government and resulted from a slave revolution was just too threatening for the U.S., which of course was still living in a slave system up until that time. We have supported almost every dictatorial government since Duvalier, but even before that, we started and established the Haitian army. And the Haitian army has had only one enemy throughout its existence, and that's been the Haitian people. After Jean-Claude Duvalier left in 1987, we supported with great energy and enthusiasm the various junta leaders, starting with Henri Nanfi, going through Prosperaville, and others. And then, at the same time, we have made it our top priority in Haiti now to starve the most popularly elected president in all of the Americas, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. No matter what he may have done or not done, there is absolutely no way that the U.S. can justify its de facto sanctions against Haiti in the area of health, education, and clean water. So our role has been enormous since the very beginning of the Republic, and it has been a history that's marked by very shameful activity in which we've always sided with the wealthy, those who would capitulate to our demands. And now, with the most popular elected leader in the Western Hemisphere, we are simply sending a message to the Haitian people that the powerful United States doesn't approve of its voting choice, and therefore it will starve the Haitian people, quite literally starve the Haitian people, but also starve it of clean water, education, and health care.
There is an issue of disrespect of sovereignty and maybe a whole lot of racism.
I think that the our relationship to Haiti is deeply embedded in racism. This is the first country that staged a successful slave revolution and established a republic. That has been a sore point since 1804, and it not only showed up the hypocrisy and the horror of slavery in the United States during the early 1800s, but ever since then, we feel that there's been a deep suspicion, and the Haitian people certainly feel that way, that there's been a deep suspicion of anything that's happening in Haiti that is supported by the people. I think that racism is very much a part of it now. Look at the interdiction policies in terms of Haitian boat people who are coming over. Haitians are the only ones who are singled out for imprisonment when they come seeking political asylum. Now we know that they've broadened that definition and said, we won't just say Haitians. We'll say anyone who comes to Florida by boat. The vast majority of those people are Haitians, and so it's essentially still a Haitian-focused policy. It simply says, we'll take a draconian measure and simply extend it to other people. That's not a solution.
Listening to Dr. Kim giving a historical description of the embargo against Haiti and the USA's continuous disrespect of Haiti's sovereignty brings home questioning the drive behind the sanctions and the talk of the regime change in Iraq. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Rim Katkhuda from WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C., talking with Dr. Jim Kim, the director of the Program for Infectious Diseases and Social Change at Harvard Medical School in Boston.
Finally, tonight we present this musical collage from Skidmark Bob and Pop Defect Radio.
And you're tuned to Pop Defect Radio. Subversive music for dangerous times.
The threat comes from Iraq. It arises directly from the Iraqi regime's own actions. Its history of aggression, and its drive toward an arsenal of terror. It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons. As a former chief weapons inspector of the UN has said,
never been about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. It's always been about regime removal, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, because neoconservatives who populate the Bush administration have invested a tremendous amount of political capital into that. They have boxed themselves into a rhetorical corner, demonizing Saddam Hussein to the point that they have given themselves no ability to maneuver. They have to remove Saddam, and having invested so much political capital, they will suffer if they don't. And frankly speaking, because the Bush administration is not honest in regards to the disarming of Iraq, because they have put regime removal ahead of disarming Iraq, we must question their motives for what they're trying to do.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
They will clear the way for immediate action. They will predetermine the outcome, which will of course be regime removal, by stacking the deck against weapons inspections. And then the danger is they will manipulate the inspections in such a manner that they will provoke a crisis, and then they already have this automatic trigger in place against Saddam. That's now how it works.
Iraq's weapons of mass destruction are controlled by a murderous tyrant. The entire world has witnessed Iraq's 11-year history of defiance, deception, and bad faith. It has given shelter and support to terrorism and practices terror against its own people.
Fear of the unknown preys upon ignorance. Since September 11, the American public has been susceptible to the politics of fear, the politics of the ignorant, and have been, you know, able to be readily convinced by speculative rhetoric that Iraq poses a threat worthy of war, and the Bush administration has capitalized upon this.
Is it the responsibility of free people to do something, to take steps to deal with such a threat before such an attack occurs?
Yes, Mr. Rumsfeld, I think we need weapons inspections, not war. Why is it stopping the inspections? I think we need weapons inspections, not war.
In a September 7th press conference with Prime Minister Tony Blair at Camp David, President Bush cited a report by the International Atomic Energy Agency that said Iraq was 6 months away from developing a nuclear weapon when inspectors pulled out in 1998. The agency now says they never published such a report. David Albright worked at the agency from 1992 to 1997. He's now president of the Institute for Science and International Security. And he says that any time frame for Iraqi nuclear development would have been speculation. They had essentially had nothing in 1998. I mean, there were suspicions that there were some activities. A term of art would be maybe they're spinning a centrifuge or two someplace. Albright says there was never consensus within the agency on the time Iraq would need to develop nuclear weapons. The White House has said that the president misspoken was referring to a 1991 report by the agency. The agency claims no 1991 report on timing was released.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying?
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Josh Chaffin, Matt Bradley, Ingrid Drake, Cha Ross Estes, and Tom Gomez. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.
Or hearts grown hard and cold.